Hi, this is Leo Laporte, prehistoric podcaster and host at twit.tv. You're listening to the amazing Curious Minds podcast.
From PI Media, this is Curious Minds. I'm Ran Levy. Heroes of Podcasting, a special series on the history and future of podcasting. In this episode, Todd Cochrane, CEO and founder of Rogue Voice, Blueberry, and the host of Geek News Central podcast.
The parties were more fun than the conferences, right? And, you know, and we're carrying out 20 trash bags of liquor bottles and stuff the next morning to make sure that the maids wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't get thrown out of the hotel. The red coats are coming. My warning to podcasters right now, the suits are coming. And they're circling the wagons. And when we can capture drive digitally, FM's doomed.
Welcome to Curious Minds and Heroes of Podcasting series, the series in which we explore the history and future of podcasting through the personal stories of some of the very first podcasting pioneers. This time we have with us Todd Cochrane, which I had the pleasure to meet in the Podcast Movement Convention in Chicago in July of 2016. Todd was rather busy with talks he gave during the convention and running Blueberry's booth, but I managed to lure him into an unoccupied conference room and interview him about his story. As you'll soon hear, it's an amazing story, which began with a serious injury, but ultimately led to Todd's maybe surprising career as an early entrepreneur in the new media of podcasting. You'll notice that the audio quality of this interview is a bit rough when compared to the usual standards of Curious Minds, but hopefully it will not be too rough. Enjoy the interview.
Sure, my name is Todd Cochrane. I am the host of the Geek News Central podcast. I also do a show where I'm a co-host with Rob Greenlee with a new media show. Also the founder and CEO of Raw Voice, which most people know us as Blueberry. Raw Voice is the parent company, but most folks know us as Blueberry. But I've been a podcaster since October 12th, 2004.
Which is probably one of the first few people who did podcast.
Yeah, and you know, we kind of laugh about it when you're like, yeah, maybe we're in the top 50 or first 50. Not top, but first 50. So it was... It was an exciting time to start podcasting back then, and very difficult. It was not technologically easy as it is today.
What did you do prior to your podcasting involvement?
Well, that's kind of funny. You know, I've had like a bit of an online life the whole time. Back in the 80s, I ran what was commonly known then as a bulletin board. So I had a dial-up BBS. Yep, I ran a BBS for many, many years. A multi-line system that moved with me wherever I was at in the military. So I started that in California in probably, 88, 89 time frame. Took it with me to Guam in 91, came back to the States. And it built to be a pretty big system. But then, of course, the internet hit. And I actually took the BBS from an online system, from a dial-in system to an internet-based system. But, you know, in like 2003, 2002, the BBS scene was dead. And I started blogging. And believe me, I was not a good blogger. Writing is not, I can hardly speak English, let alone write English. So the website was just a place where I blogged about technology. And that kind of leads to the genesis of the show, where in 2004, early 2004, I got hurt very badly overseas, spent 13 days in the hospital, could no longer fly for the Navy. I was wearing a clamshell. Basically, I had broke my back. So they assigned me to a desk. And I end up in Waco, Texas, of all places, babysitting airplanes, doing contract enforcement. So I spent a lot of time in my hotel because it was 100 degrees in Waco, and I was wearing this body cast. Not fun to be outside. And I heard about this thing called podcasting, and I love to talk. So literally, I went across the highway divide to Walmart and picked up a $12 LabTech headset and recorded the first two editions of the show with just a $12 headset. It was from there we were off to the races.
So what was the first time you ever heard a podcast? Or
I actually heard Adam Curry and Dave Weiner on the Daily Source Code. I heard them talking. I'd listened to four or five episodes. And we were still in the stage where active development of the first podcasting app was going. We were still sorting out RSS issues. You know, it was really, I mean, like
early days.
And my website at the time was on movable type. And most people probably don't even know that CMS at all. But WordPress maybe was in existence. I'm not 100% sure. But I was on movable type for the first 2 years I did my show. And we essentially had to build our own code to create an RSS feed. And that was what really allowed me to have full control of my show from the very, very beginning as we put the time in and built. We had a technology, you know, there was no easy way to do it. People were doing RSS feeds by hand in some cases, or there was tools to do them by hand. But that wasn't even the most crazy part. So here I am, this not necessarily good blogger, and I start my podcast, and 300 listened to the first show, 900. There was no stats. So how we were figuring out our how much listeners we had was by the amount of bandwidth we were using. We take the show size, divide it by the bandwidth, and coming up with the numbers. Well, I went from 900 to 3,000 to like 11,000. In 30 days, I had 45,000 people listening to my show. Okay, so there was no Blueberry. There was no Libsyn. So how do you support that type of traffic, the bandwidth? So I had as many as 12 shared hosting accounts. I had a shared hosting account with everyone. I had one with Bluehost. I had one with DreamHost. I had two or three with GoDaddy. I mean, I had hosting accounts everywhere, and they were all assigned to names like s1geeknewcentral.com, s2.geek. So they were all had their own domains. So we would burn through the bandwidth 2.5 to 3 days, maybe 2 days at the most. I'd burn through 500 gigs of traffic, and then I would have to, when I uploaded the shows, I uploaded them to 12 sites. Cause I had to change the URLs.
Skip URLs.
So it was massive trouble to just stay online with that kind of an audience and not like go broke. And so I did this like for a month in Waco, and I went home to my wife and I said, got this new thing I'm doing. And she held up her hand. She put two fingers up. She says, bud, you got 2 years. You got 2 years to figure out how to make money on this thing. Because, you know, like all guys, we all have our money pits. We have our hobbies, right? And the bulletin board had been kind of a money pit at the end. So she didn't want another sideline. It was a big commitment. I told her, I said, this is two nights a week. Monday and Thursday night, I said this because I was out of job. Like most podcasters, like 99% of the podcasters out there, I had a day job and come home and deal with the kids. I've got three children, and actually four, but one from a previous marriage, but three at the time at home that were small. Actually, there was only two at home at the time. The third one came later. And it was crazy. And then, so what ended up happening then? Very short order, December of 04, I got this email from a company called Wiley Publishing. Had no clue. Remember, I'm not a good blogger, right? Not a good writer. And they wrote me an email that basically said, we want you to write the first book on podcasting. Now, excuse my French, but my response to the publisher was, you have got to be shitting me. That was the email response I sent to Wiley Publishing. They replied back to me, no, we're not shitting you. We want you to write the first book in podcasting. Why didn't you look us up on the internet? So I looked them up on the internet and then felt like a total nerd or an ass because it was like, you know, they do the book for dummies. So
they're famous.
Yeah, they're a big company. Yeah. So We signed a deal. I think I'm the only podcaster that actually got a cash advance. Maybe some of the others did, but I actually got a cash advance for the book. It was a very good book deal. So I started writing the book in January. So, of course, I'm sealed to secrecy, right? And I'm about 6 weeks into writing the book. I've got a 4 or 5 month deadline to get it done. And I get a phone call one. It's a Saturday morning. I got a phone call from a guy in the mainland. He's well known today in the podcasting space. And he said, "Hey, Todd, can I talk to you about podcasting?" So, sure. So we talked on the phone for 2 hours. I said, "So, you know, what are you doing all this research for?" "So I'm writing a book."
He said.
Yeah, he told me he was writing a book. I said, "Oh, really?" You know, and I'm kind of like inside going, "Uh-oh." I said, "When's your publishing date?" And he told me. So he knows this now, but as soon as we got off the phone, I called my publisher and I said, "I'm going to, guess what?
There's competition."
"There's competition." And they said, "Okay, when's their publishing date?" And my publisher got a little bit concerned. He says, "Can you be finished in 4 weeks?" And I'm like, "Yes." So we went to press almost 3 months early to be the first book on the street. And ultimately, it sold out 45,000 copies. It was the wow. number one selling do-it-yourself book. I got awards from Amazon, New York Times. For a tech book, that was incredible numbers.
It means that there were a lot of people who were already interested in podcasting.
A lot.
We were talking about
May of 2005. Yeah. But, you know, there's an interesting thing. In the early days of podcasting, there was this listener and podcaster mantra of it was evil to take money. So I announced my book deal, and I had a beautiful audience. I was probably up to 90 to 100,000 people listening to my show at that time. And the bandwidth situation was starting to resolve itself. You know, we were starting to be able to, you know, basically do the show without having to worry about breaking the bank. But when I told my audience, this was on episode 69, ironically, when I told my audience about the book deal, overnight, I lost 50% of my audience. I got hundreds of emails from people saying, "You sold out." It was really a different time in the podcasting space. So,
what did you accuse you of?
They didn't accuse. Well, you got to understand it. Again, 2004, 2005, the idea was you're doing it for the art, you're doing it for the love, you're doing it for the telling the story, which is all true. But as soon as they thought you brought money into the scene, it would ruin things. You know, meanwhile, companies were starting to start up. Libsyn were starting around that time. A variety of, people were getting venture capital. It was, you know, so the money was coming into the space. And, you know, really the money helped drive the advancement of the space beyond what it was at the time. So I, that was a blow. And it really set me back in my seat a little bit. And it's humbling. And little by little, many of those audience members came back because it came back for the content, not necessarily because I'd sold out for the book. But the phone rang in June of 2005, and it was GoDaddy. And Chris Redlinger was the GoDaddy rep, and she said, "We want to advertise on your show." So by the time we got the deal together, this would have been July of 2005. I started, matter of fact, this is the 12th year. GoDaddy has continued to sponsor my show continuously.
Ever since then.
So we did the first month's deal. And the end results was incredible. Simply incredible, the number of new customers that signed up with GoDaddy that first month. So, of course, they wanted to renew. I had charged them, woefully undercharged them for the advertisement space. I didn't know. I was just wasn't educated on how much to charge. So after she told me how many customers I had brought into the company, new customers, I took some time and I, you know, used my calculator and a spreadsheet, and I basically put together what that deal was really worth. And I went back with a counter offer, and they agreed too quickly. So I learned a couple of things in that process on that renegotiation that I should have even asked for more money than I did. I was very conservative. But I learned something from that conservative deal. It's better to be conservative with a deal and have a lifetime advertiser than to be too greedy and have them for a short period.
The quick buck is less important than the long-term.
My show from GoDaddy has earned, and I had told this last year, so this is not not public information, but my show's made in excess of $1 million from GoDaddy sponsorship over 12 years. So that, well, what that really led to then was them, her saying, and the magic words were, do you know of any other podcasters that would like advertising? And instantly in my head, the idea of a business formed. I was still active duty in the military. I had a day job. I was deploying, doing shows from the barracks room on the road. Wherever I could find a quiet spot, I mean, the show had to go on. I was still, you know, active duty, and retired in late 2007, January, actually December of 2007. So the at that point, then, the space was obviously exploding. We were up from, you know, starting of October 04 to May, June of 2005. There were already many networks launched. We launched the Tech Podcast Network, which is at techpodcast.com. Actually, in January of 05, I started understanding the value of bundling shows together to work, to build audience share. It was remarkable, the power of networks. A lot of podcasters don't understand the value of networks today. And you get 10, 11, 12 like-minded shows that are cross-promoting and talking about each other. And you are, you know, you'll lose a few, you'll gain a few, and then you build as a group together. Being part of a huge network may not be as advantageous, but smaller networks of like-minded content creators has tremendous value. And so I was actually the first to actually build a network too. Quickly, many followed. Matter of fact, a lot of the presentations I made at events were talking about building networks in the early days. But so in July of 05, this business idea, because of what GoDaddy said, they need more. And I'm trying to think, okay, what's the right revenue share? And my first revenue share I did with the Tech Podcast Network was 90-10. And 90% to the podcasters, 10% to me. And I quickly learned that the model work I was doing to make these deals happen was worth a higher market share. And I went to 70-30. And that's what today is what Raw Voices market. That's our split today. Other companies do 50-50. I think we're the only ones that do a 70-30. We understand that we're all creators. So we understand the value that the creator brings. Without the creator, there's no deal.
So, interesting to know, how did the audience first receive advertisements on your show?
Well, I think
the mindset was different.
I told them. I just started telling them. And you know, that's what was kind of shocking because of the Show 69 situation. Because I had told the audience from the beginning that I needed to make the show work financially. You know, every guy has got every married
has a family,
and sometimes wives give ultimatums, and sometimes we just shake our heads and say yes, dear. So I was under the gun to figure out how to monetize the show and pay for my time, because let's be honest, I'd asked them to give up Monday and Thursday nights every night, and they have for 12 years. Unless there's a death, wedding, even birthdays we celebrate on the next day or before.
It's a real commitment.
It's a commitment. And or a graduation. Now, I'm a little more lenient now than I was in the beginning, but I went 4 years without taking one show off. I never missed an episode for 4 years. And sometimes I did more when I was at trade show events. But the so the money situation was solved. Money's coming in. And I basically did a call out on my show, said, hey, I need a lawyer. I need a biz dev. I need a graphics guy. I need a programmer. I've got a business idea. Here's a telephone number. Told my audience, if you're interested, call in on this date and time. And when we got on the phone, I basically said, okay, if you don't have X number of dollars to invest today in an idea that I'm going to present to you, hang up. And I think like 5 of the 9 hung up. And from that call, Barry Kantz, my legal officer and CFO, Angela Mandato, which he came about a week later, Brian Yonke, our graphics director, and another individual who's no longer with the company, formed the company. And then later, Jeff Hines joined our board of directors. So from that call and from my audience and from Brian being friends with Angelo, the 5 people that started the core of the company, we started a company without seeing each other face-to-face. And we all wrote checks without seeing each other face-to-face. They became as listeners of the show. Yep, they were already part of my Ohana, part of my family of listeners. So there's a lot of faith and trust, and we met each other face to face for the first time maybe 6 months later. And everyone was still working full time jobs, and as we could afford financially bring people on the payroll, we did. So some of the team members are still part time. Barry Kantz, our CFO, he's still part time. Barry really never needed to come on full time. He gets a stipend every month for part of being the owner of the company. But, in the long run here, the first thing we did was build a stats platform because we were doing advertising deals. So the history of the company from there goes forward. But going back to the podcasting space in general, we're here at Podcast Movement, and the first convention was the New Media Expo. It happened in Ontario, California in 2005. And from that starting point, the podcasting community was unlike any other convention. You go to these shows now, and while I meet a lot of new people, I see a lot of old friends. It's like a family reunion. It's very social. The competitors, while we compete, we're friends. We can talk to each other in the hallway, text each other on Slack. You know, there's no collusion because we all compete very aggressively against one another. But we,
it's a community. Yeah. Small community.
Yeah. And we're friends, and we talk about issues, and we try to work, try to help better the community. So that started, the genesis of this space started then. And it was because 90% of the people in the business at the time were all creators. They were all content. They were podcasters. So we understood the struggles that it took to build an audience. Now, being on the ground floor, I was blessed being early, but I still had to work over the years to continue to build my audience just as hard as any other podcaster. It's not easy to build an ad audience. And I do every, I wouldn't say trick in the book, but I try a lot of things to build audience even today. And I'm lucky enough, I talk to a lot of people and keep my ear to the ground. And, all this stuff's available for any content creator. If you listen to the podcasters, if you listen to Dave Jackson, you listen to Dan or Jay Lewis, you listen to all the folks that are doing podcast shows about growing and building your podcast. If a podcaster subscribes to 5 of those, they're going to pull a nugget out of every show. So I listen to all these guys.
And you're still listening.
Oh, absolutely.
Still learning.
You have to. And I'm 12 years in space, so I'm the dinosaur. They say you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but if you're not listening and working, you're going to lose audience. You have to continue to be, my show hasn't changed, but the way I approach gaining new audience members and stuff. But going back to 05 for the New Media Expo, and it was held a couple of years. It was crazy. I mean, it was truly wild. Blueberry was new. We were making money. Not a lot of people were on payroll, so I had no overhead. So we threw these, insanely crazy parties. I would rent 2 or 3 rooms on either side of a suite, up below it and above it, and we'd have like the presidential suite at a hotel. And there would be 300 podcasters, music, drinking. It was a blast. the parties were more fun than the conferences, right? And, you know, and we're carrying out 20 trash bags of liquor bottles and stuff the next morning to make sure that the maids wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't get thrown out of the hotel. So, you know, and then the parties moved to when we went to Vegas, parties moved to offsite events. We don't have parties quite like we used to today. So maybe someday we'll have to throw an old retro party and you know, it got kind of crazy. It would be like a body painting. And yeah, I mean, there are some stories that are still going to be locked up and are not fit to be told on a podcast.
That's the hidden side of the podcasting
Oh, my God. But it was,
sex,
you know,
drugs, and podcasting.
There was no drugs. I was active duty. So I was like, you guys can drink and do whatever you want.
I was still a soldier.
I was still then. I was like, no weed. If you're smoking weed, you got to leave the room. And, you know, if, for me, smoking weed, I'd get busted. You know, I can't even be around it. I'm like, no weed smoking in the room. So there was no drugs that I know of that happened at our parties. But plenty of alcohol and all other craziness and people that...
By the way, the name Blueberry, yeah. Where does it come from?
You know, we started off with, you know, the startups at the time, it was, you know, no vowels were like the in thing. And we were trying to, you know, you're brainstorming an idea. So actually the company started Raw Voice. So raw content and your voice. That makes sense. Raw voice. And perfect. And then we called it Fresh Organic Media was our headline. And the Raw Voice the Raw Voice logo in the beginning was supposed to look like a carrot. But it was supposed to look like a microphone, but everyone thought it was a carrot. Which makes my graphics guy mad to this day. It's not a carrot. It's a microphone. So when we were getting ready to launch, we launched a site called Podcaster News, PCN. It was ahead of its time. It was like, CNN has accomplished it. Well, the man on the street records a video, sends it to CNN. That's what PCN was. It was supposed to be like quick reaction news podcast style. And, that kind of didn't stick. So after a year of business, I believe we launched Blueberry in July of 06 at Gnomedex. And the site wasn't ready 3 minutes before I went on the stage. And Angela got the code final, literally 3 minutes before the event started. And I was able to show it off. But the that's a story in itself. The but trying to come up with the name of Blueberry, it's like, okay, bunches. Blueberries come in a bunch. So we thought, okay, this is going to be a network, fits in with our Fresh Organic Media theme. In retrospect, 2020, you never, how companies' names and sites are formed are just kind of bizarre. And we probably could have took a little more time in the beginning. But, you know, it is what it is. It is. So people call us Blueberry and, you know, every... But it's Blueberry. It sounded pronounced it just like a blueberry without the E's. But, and really our focus has been provide great tools and get out of the way. Make sure that our branding is not interposed on theirs, on the content creators. You know, one of the reasons we built PowerPress, we were quite happy with PodPress. And then one of the businesses that was underwriting PodPress went out of business with 3 days before Christmas, which left literally thousands of podcasters high and dry. And this developer decided, well, I'm not being paid no more, so kind of lost interest in developing the plugin. So we basically rewrote PodPress and made PowerPress. And that was, we really didn't, to be honest with you, I was worried for the podcast community. It wasn't even, in the beginning, it wasn't even a business consideration. It was more, we need to get something on the street. So I said, let's build it. You know, we spent 3 or 4 months of company capital to build the initial plugin and put it out there just because we knew PodPress wasn't being maintained. We were worried about vulnerabilities. Plus, I wanted a bunch of new features that weren't going to get implemented. Then we released PowerPress, and then I told Angela, I said, you know, so many people are using our stats. Why don't we make it so that they can automatically connect to the stat system and link their accounts? And we thought that was a good idea and wrote that linking code. And But something interesting happened. Our advertising business, from 2005 to just even after the recession, when stuff started coming back here in the U.S., 2005 to 2010 was simply incredible. The money being spent by the advertisers was, for the time, simply remarkable. We were doing $500,000 a quarter on advertising. And it was just a few companies spending that big money, and mostly tech-related.
And it is partly so today.
No, it's shifted.
It shifted?
It has shifted. It's not fully focused on tech, for sure. There's a good... Right. We just signed a faith-based deal a couple of days ago. So it shows you the diversity of the advertising. But I was worried about our business model. If these advertisers went away, we would be screwed. So I said, let's look at what else we can do. And we said, let's do this hosting. So we started media hosting, tied it into to PowerPress. And really, that was really the genesis of being able to post, upload, and publish, writing your own dashboard. We've always been a company about owning your IP, owning your domain, not letting third parties control, because what we've seen is so many podcasting companies go out of business, and they usually do it at a drop of a hat. There's no warning. They're like, okay, you've got 2 weeks to move, or you've got 3 days to move. And I was like, I want to have a vehicle to be able to onboard content creators that may be in a situation where a company's going under, and we haven't had any of that in a while. Thank goodness, knock on wood. And it opened up a new business model for us. So actually what was happening is, as the advertising dollars were going down, the hosting business was going up. They kind of met in the middle, and we didn't have to ever lay any people off. Matter of fact, we started adding bodies, and it's allowed us to do a lot more. Now, you know, programmers, you love them to death. If they tell you something's going to take 3 months, it's going to take six. Or sometimes nine, you know, depending on the how many rabbit holes they go down. But I've got a great team that is trying to push the boundaries. We've got a long list of stuff we want to do. But it, really, everything that we've done, and this is something that worries me about the podcasting space today, is in the beginning, we were all podcasters. The business owners were all podcasters. They were all doing business. So today, I can count on one hand the number of businesses that have podcasters that are actively podcasting. Libsyn, they have active podcasting going on with their company. Spreaker, active podcasting going on in their company. Us, active podcasting going on in the company, where we're actually building shows, doing the down in the dirt weeds, creating content. I don't know if I can say that about the rest of our competitors out there. So do they really understand the podcasting space? Are they a suit and they're looking to capitalize? So my biggest caution today, and I don't want to sound alarmist, but if a podcaster is offered some sort of exclusive deal, let's say it's an advertising deal and it requires exclusivity, we've seen exclusive deals before. And while they may sound good on paper, oftentimes they don't pan out. So if I was to sign an exclusive deal today, I would say I will be guaranteed X number of dollars per month. Even if you don't find an advertiser for me, you want me to be exclusive, write me a check. So I would encourage podcasters, if you're doing an exclusive deal, require a minimum amount that you may have been able to get on your own, or maybe a deal that would have came from, you know, PodTrack or Libsyn or Blueberry. You got to be able to protect yourself. Also, if they ask you to move your feed or move your show, don't do it. Stay in your .com. Make them syndicate or pull in your feed, but keep control of that brand. Hold it for dear life, because we have a saying here in America. It's every kid learns it in 1776 when they signed the Declaration of Independence. The British came, and there was the redcoats are coming, the redcoats are coming. My sign, my warning to podcasters right now, the suits are coming, the suits are coming. And they're circling the wagons. And believe me, they want a big piece of this industry. So creators, you are the radio stations. you know, if you go to a radio station, is their GM, and they have jocks and they have talk show hosts and other things that are part of that station. They are the talent. When an advertiser comes to a radio station, they don't talk to the jocks and the talent. They talk to the GM. The GM could care less what the jocks and the talent want for advertisers. So that's why you hear all these weird advertisements on radio at the middle of the night, or some sort of erectile dysfunction ad, or whatever it may be that is on the radio that you're like, that's weird.
Brand identity is much less important.
They don't care. There's no brand identity. Involved. Right. So they want the cash, and they'll take almost any deal. So what the corporate America, the corporate entities that are entering the podcasting space, they don't care about, most of them don't care about your brand or identity. All they're worried about is moving volume. But because you're the GM, you're going to be able to say, no, that's going to hurt my audience. Now, there may come a time where we have to decide whether or not we want to be able to grow the advertising space in the for shows that aren't getting advertising. And we may at some point, and I'm not saying that I'm ready to get to this part of the podcasting space, but we may get to a part where we have to bring in more volume to advertisers, be able to take a little more advertising at a little lower rate, and to get it more basically what we want to do, we want to get the advertisers fighting over this content. We want bidding wars, because we know that once an advertiser gets into a show, they very rarely leave. And when they're in and they're having good success, whether it be direct response or a brand advertiser, they'll up the cost just to keep the shows on the campaign. So at some point, we're going to have to make some transitions, and there'll be a little bit of risk involved. I'm not willing to sacrifice CPMs on host read advertising. I will never sacrifice CPMs, cost per thousand, essentially, which typically is in the 20 to 25 range, to go to some sort of system that may be brokered or automated, because those CPMs are going to be half of that, if that, and or produce spots. And I don't know if podcasters are ready for produce spots. But, you know, there's going to be podcasters that are going to be going into Google Play. They're going to go into Spotify. They're going to go into iHeartRadio. They're having advertising run against their shows today, pre-roll, post-roll. You get what you do in the middle of the show, but you're not getting a penny for anything that's run on either side. And you have no decision point. So podcasters are going to have to decide whether they're willing their brand to have this geriatric product run before their show, or diapers, or whatever it may be. So we're going to come to a transition point here very, very quickly.
But what do you say to people who say that advertisers don't want to mess with individual podcasters and writing copies and, you know, the hustle of getting an advertisement ran?
Well,
they prefer buying in bulk.
Well, those advertisers then are losing out on what the true value of the podcaster's host endorsement message is, and being allowing the podcasters to be creative. I have yet to this date gotten, well, I shouldn't say this. I've gotten some copy that is good, but oftentimes I have to go back to the media buyer and say, okay, this is like radio copy. Let's make some changes. Let's allow the podcasters to have some talking points. Long as we get the call to action and we get the message of the product across, let's be a little more flexible. The podcasters often do a much better job in transitioning into a spot and doing a host endorsement and being able, because number one, we make them reuse it. Podcasters I have on deals, if they don't like the product, they don't participate. So that kind of, you know, so we'll see what happens with the advertising space. A lot of podcasters don't want advertising. You know, they just love the fan engagement, and, you know,
they're not doing it for the money.
No, and they're like that original 2004 group that were like, we're doing it for the art. And some people may say it's not the art, but some folks do it for business reason. Some want to gain more social, basic exposure. But typically, if a person's doing it for, you know, it doing it just to do it, those audiences don't necessarily always come. But, you know, I can actually say, I remember the good old days of podcasting, but it's all been good. These are the good days for still podcasting. Good. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And, you know, I told my audience, and it runs true today, I have a great sponsor. My sponsor feeds my family and keeps the lights on. And I tell them every listen, they do. They keep my lights on and they keep my family fed and the gas in the car and my insurance and all that. And I would give it up in a minute if it quit being fun. If it's not fun, if it's a job, I had a job before. You know, I had a job where, you know, I had a job where the boss told you what to do and you did it, or you faced serious consequences. And I became that boss that was giving those orders too. I don't want a job anymore. I want to have, you know, a fun time. And many, this is the hope of many podcasters is that it doesn't take a big audience to replace the day job. It takes a medium sized audience, but you can't do it. It's not the 120 characters tweet. It's a steady push of consistent content on a regular basis. And superior consistent content will gain you an audience.
That's what I'm always saying to new podcasters. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint.
It is a marathon. Yeah, for sure. But I don't know if that you know kind of covers us on what happened there. I mean, we could probably talk about a lot of stuff from the early days, but just, you know, for new podcasters today, man, be thankful. It was hard. It was, and that's why in the beginning, it's why we're such a huge number of tech shows, because the techies could overcome the technological hurdles to get their show up and running. And those that were, you know, it wasn't about just let's do a podcast and start tomorrow like you can today. It was like maybe a couple weeks to figure this out. And there wasn't, you had to go to multiple places and it wasn't clear. And it quickly changed.
Many obstacles on the way.
There was a lot of tech obstacles. I was never so happy to get rid of those multiple hosting accounts. It was crazy. And the work just to keep the show on. You know, you woke up in the middle of the night from remember, it was before the iPhone. We were on the iPod. So there's a lot of people listening to this that never not had an iPhone. So we were talking about remembering to put your iPod or your MP3 player, which there was many at the time, on your serial cable to make sure that iTunes program was loaded and that it synced. Because if you didn't, you'd get in the car the next morning and you would have no content and you were mad, but there was nothing you could do. You went to work, you came home at night, and then you synced and you got access to new programming. It was very hard, even for the listeners, to get you. And so we were limited by audience size because of that. And then when the iPod was, or the iPhone was introduced, oh man, it was a holy grail. Now we've got a data connected phone, but the data plans at the time were horrible and expensive. So everyone was continuing to sync anyway. So if most people, we've only had a dedicated podcast app for a few years. And I hear a lot of people bitching and moaning about that app. Well, I'm going to be very frank. When iTunes launched in July of 2005 with podcasting enabled, the space doubled overnight. Overnight doubled. When the iPhone was introduced, the space doubled overnight. When the iOS podcast app was introduced, we didn't double, but we grew significantly. And the reason was, and what it continues to be a small hurdle in the Android side, is there was a dedicated app and a dedicated button you could put on your website, and you click it once with the mobile device, your phone loads the app, you subscribe,
that's it.
So that's why in May of 16, no, 15, excuse me, I'm getting my years ahead of myself, we introduced a one-click subscribe on Android, and today there are 12 Android apps that support one-click. And what we really did is wrote a very simple piece of code. We gifted this to the community. Any of our competitors can implement it, which they haven't have, which you need to ask why. Why would a competitor be, if we give them the ability, a non-branded solution to be able to get listeners to be able to subscribe to one of 12 apps automatically, same way you do via iOS, why would they not implement that on their website? I think it's criminal. And we also have, there's also podcasters that haven't implemented on their own, which they can. So, you know, you've got 50-50 in the United States. 50% of people have an iPhone, 50% have an Android device, and maybe 1% has a Microsoft phone. It's probably more than that, but it's still minimal numbers. So why would podcasters ignore this other segment of the potential audience? We could double. And what we're actually seeing today, because it's included with PowerPress, and if they put the subscribe sidebar on their website, it's automatically there. So we're seeing about 100,000 clicks a week of people clicking on one-click subscribe on Android. So someone is gaining 100,000 new listeners a week. And majority of them are the 50,000, close to 60,000 PowerPress users. Those shows are gaining listeners every week. So if we just divide it out, let's say each they get a new listener a week. That may not sound like a lot. Some are getting some are more, some are getting less, but still
in the long run
it's substantial.
Where do you see yourself, your company, your podcast in like 5-10 years from now?
Oh.
Or where do you hope to be?
5 or 10 years ago. Well, our goal was to close the loop on our service offering, and we have done that. So every hosting customer today gets a free WordPress site and pro stats. We introduce a product called Podcaster Radio that allows podcasters to be able to get their on-demand podcast into a linear internet radio stream automatically. We'll continue to build out social. Social is high on my agenda. Our stat system is getting a complete rework right now. I'm sure we will continue to innovate as ideas come in for PowerPress. Matter of fact, we have a wall full of a list of ideas that we want to implement. So there's a lot to do code-wise. 5 years, that's a tough one. 5 years, 5 years every podcaster's getting a check. Whether it be dinner money, car payment money, house money, they're getting a check. And running advertising in their shows that align with their podcast. In 5 years, I would hope that's where we would be at. I would have thought 5 years ago we would already be at that point today. But radio is multi-billion dollar business with massive debt. iHeartRadio, they are massively in debt. They are in huge trouble. They have payments in the billions due, you know, because they went up and collected a whole bunch of radio stations across the country, and then radio started falling off a cliff. Radio's not going anywhere anytime soon. It's still going to be a major dominant force in the space. They're starting to podcast as well. So in 5 years, you're going to see every radio station in the country having some independent content. They will have segmented segments of drive that are a podcast. They have to go digital. I have a 12-year-old, and in the car, he is not listening to the radio. He is plugged in on Pandora or whatever, but in 12 more years, that 12-year-old will be in the workforce, probably have a girlfriend, at some point getting engaged, maybe children, and then what will his taste and his consumption needs will change. We all love music, but at some point in our lives, we're like, maybe I need to get smart or continued education on something else or entertained. So, the audience share is going to grow just because, and radio is continuing to decline because of this. My 12-year-old has never, he's always had a DVR. He's always been able to do on demand. I remember rabbit ears. Yes, it's the norm. I remember rabbit ears, you know, and having to sit through commercials. There was no fast forwarding, you know, and that wasn't so that long ago. So, we'll see a lot more radio in the space.
Do you think that FM has any commercial viability in the next 10, 20 years?
I think
having
there's
giant transmitters.
I think FM has still got a long life ahead of it. Now, here's the disruptor. Cars. So as people, I've got a 2009 Mazda CX-9. It was fully loaded at the time I bought it, drove it off the lot. It has Bluetooth. So I can play shows through the Bluetooth on the, but today, if I'm going to go out and buy a car today in 2016, it's going to have digital, it's going to have, could have Android, built it could in. Be CarPlay, it'll be built in. So just like television, where the competition was for HDMI 1, so your cable box that you get, you plug that in HDMI 1 and when you turn on the TV, the battle was for HDMI 1. And I kind of say that jokingly because TVs today have 5 or 6 HDMI plugins, but before they had just one. Right, so that isn't the case anymore. But still, the battle was the Roku box. Now, for many people, are becoming the primary plug-in for their television. So the car, when you turn the car on in the near future, FM 100 is not going to be the default thing that's going to turn on. It's going to be Pandora. It's going to be your podcast app. And when we can capture drive digitally, FM's doomed. When more cars in the country have connectivity, whether it's tethered to your phone or whether it has its own internet connection, FM is doomed. Now, here's really the, I'm holding up my iPhone and shaking it. Most of us today are in our cars connected to Bluetooth, listening to stuff via our phones. So this still continues and will be the number one disruptor for a long, long time. So I think what we will end up seeing is, as our kids get older, as soon as my 12-year-old is old enough to drive, well, I tell you what happens when my 18-year-old gets in the car, then my family, driver rules the radio. First thing he
that's
does,
the family rule.
That's the family rule. Dad doesn't control it, the driver controls the radio, much to my chagrin sometimes. So he gets in the car, what does he do? Bam. And I usually have it on Bluetooth anyway, but he syncs it to his Bluetooth, or he plugs it in via the jack, and I listen to his 18-year-old music and get educated on what kids are listening to.
Against your will.
Against my will, off, and I'm putting in a set of headphones and I'm listening to something else. So
that mirrors my experience with my daughter. She's 10 years old, but she only listens to YouTube with the songs.
Right. So as you know, as these kids grow up, they're going to plug in. Now, they're not going to listen to podcasts in the beginning. Let's be honest. Everyone that's older than 25. What were we doing 18 to 25? We were drinking, chasing guys or girls, depending on your preference, partying, going to the clubs, going to school, hanging out with friends. You know, and even after you're 25, some of us still did that. Then your priorities change, right? And, you have to pay off that college loan, so you're working, you're at the entry level of your job and you're competing with old guys like me and, you're trying to make your mark in the world. So you're starting to consume content that helps better yourself. So that's how we win. And we've been winning. And the older, the demographic of people listening is actually getting older too, because when I started this, I was 40. So now I'm 52. So I'm in that later age listening bracket of, how you said, wow, I got people that are 55 listening to my show. That was incredible. And now my audience has grown with me. So I have people that were 55, they're now 67. They're still listening today. So I've got them on the right hand side and got them coming in on the left. And all of us do. And if I was to create new content today, if I was the 25-year-old, I would create some cool, hip content that millennials are going to listen to. Something, because I'm not a millennial. I'm actually the last year of a boomer. So my concerns as a boomer are nowhere related to what millennials are worried about today. So I could never do a millennial show. I would be laughed out of the yeah. So millennials need to start connecting with millennials, and maybe a 10-year generation ahead, they're going to listen to those folks. So, but we're going to win. We're going to win this. But radio is going to remain. We all have to. We always said, kill radio in the beginning. This is the death of radio. I still say death to radio. I'm still a big guy on that. But we've come to realize that it's so fast. It's not going to happen as fast as we want it to.
That's it for this interview. For me, the most interesting part of the interview was when Todd told us of his experience trying to monetize his podcast. Back then, it was a courageous attempt that cost him half his audience. Today, ads are the norm in podcasting, which I believe is a good thing, since it gives this new media a financial foundation to stand upon. If it wasn't for Todd and other early podcasters who pushed for monetization, podcasting would probably still be a niche and amateurish adventure, and we wouldn't have such a rich variety of high-quality podcasts as we have today. I'd like to thank Todd Cochran and invite you to listen to his show, the Geek News Central Podcast, at geeknewscentral.com. What do you think about podcast monetization? Are there too many ads in podcasts today, or are you happy with what you're hearing? Drop me a line at ran@cmpod.net or comment on our website, cmpod.net. Tune into Curious Minds for more episodes in our series Heroes of Podcasting, including interviews with Leo Laporte from This Week in Tech and Aaron Menke from Lore Podcast. You'll find all previous episodes on our website, cmpod.net, and on iTunes. Search for Curious Minds Podcast. We're also on Twitter at Curious Minds Pod and on Facebook. Curious Minds are Kelly O'Loughlin, co-host and editor. Nir Sayag is our sound engineer, Danny Timor is our business manager, and me, Ran Levy, producer and writer. See you again next week. Bye-bye.